Hello everyone. Welcome to Nuclear Matters at CIL, a series of podcasts brought to you by the Nuclear Law and Policy Team at the Center for International Law, or CIL. Today's podcast launches a new sub-series on the governance of floating nuclear power plants, or FNPPs. Today's inaugural episode touches on some of the efforts being undertaken within the nuclear industry to promote the governance of FNPPs. I am Nivedita. Together with Denise Cheong, we will be joined in conversation by our special guest, Mr. Mikkel Bo, who amongst the multiple hats he wears, is a chair of the World Nuclear Transport Institute's Maritime Applications and Nuclear Propulsion Working Group. As part of this podcast, Mr. Bo will share his views on governance developments, challenges, and opportunities, including the World Nuclear Transport Institute's efforts to contribute to governance developments in this area.
A very warm welcome, Mikkel, to Nuclear Matters at CIL. We're very happy to have you with us today to speak about some of the efforts being undertaken by the nuclear industry to help promote the governance of floating nuclear power plants, or FNPPs. If I may, Mikkel, I'd like to start with an easy question, or maybe it's not so easy. How would you define a floating nuclear power plant? And I suppose related to that, how does an FNPP differ from a nuclear powered ship?
Well, Denise, it's a pleasure to be here as well. Thank you very much for inviting me on the podcast. A floating nuclear power plant, the way we see it and the way that we've been working around the industry to gather consensus about this, because there's a lot of talk about how you actually do define these things. For us, it is a it's a power plant that is integral to the structure of a floating platform. And that's rather different, I think, from something that you would transport as a cargo. So remember, the whole idea of this new renaissance in nuclear is that we move from project to product. And if we're going to move towards a product-based nuclear industry, which means that we're making machines, we have to factory make them. We have to be able to mass manufacture them. So the idea that you'd have to transport them around is what really complicates this matter. So if you're going to transport them around, you have the difference really between transportability and mobility. And we think that it's a logical issue. Rather than the technical issue, where you say that if you're going to be transporting small modular reactors, chances you're going to have to transport them at sea because they're very heavy. Now, if you're then putting these on, say, barges or ships to be moved from one place to the other, they're transportable. But if you install them as an integral part of either a ship or a nuclear power plant that floats on the water, then it is a floating nuclear power plant. And that's really where the nexus between those two, a nuclear powered ship and a floating nuclear power plant, comes in. The only difference between those two effectively is that one is self-propelled, or may be self-propelled, and the other isn't. So a nuclear ship, of course, has self-propulsion. That may or may not be from the nuclear power plant itself, but let's assume that it is, and it's a nuclear powered ship. The only difference between that and a floating nuclear power plant is really, you know, the purpose of the vessel, or the purpose of the floating part. So when we look at the rules around these, they are 90-95% the same. The requirements are the same. So, you know, rather than trying to define it as something very different, I think we can define these two things as really siblings in the same family.
You mentioned that the rules around both these concepts, Mikkel, are quite similar, and that's something we'll pick up later on. But for now, if I could get you maybe to share a little bit about why the interest in floating nuclear power plants, and I suppose the flip side of that would be why the concerns as well around floating nuclear power plants.
Well, you know, it flows from what I said earlier, Denise, and that's this idea that, you know, the renaissance in the nuclear industry comes from smaller machines. And with smaller machines, we have to mass manufacture them, and then we have to be able to move them around. I mean, the vast majority of the 72 of the designs of small reactors out there are several hundred tons in weight at the very minimum. If you then include containment structures and shielding, et cetera, you're probably looking at anything between, you know, 200 tons and 2,000 tons. And that's not something you can put on the back of a rail car or on the back of a truck. You have to move these things around at sea. So in effect, you have to manufacture them by the coast. And the best place to do that is in a shipyard. I mean, you could do it separately, you could co-locate it with the shipyard, but you use that mass manufacturability of the shipping industry to manufacture these machines. It stands to reason. It's the only logical way to do it. And then the idea that we would continue to build only terrestrial nuclear power plants, which are effectively large building projects with, you know, lots of concrete, and you have a supply chain that, you know, is a one-off supply chain. You have thousands of people working on a construction project, and once that's finished, you have to move those thousands of people to somewhere else. With this floating concept, we've got a different way of looking at it. You know, we can have thousands of people working on the manufacturing of many machines rather than one, and then move them. They can stay in one place, just like you do with, you know, manufacturing of aircraft or large engines or satellite, anything complicated, right? You know, you have a complex manufacturing environment. And then if you then install these on floating nuclear power plants, you know, you create an ability to then move them to where they are needed. So, you know, you could then drag them or tow them into place. You don't need the same sort of siting or site license procedure as you do when you do this on land. And you can add to it, you can subtract from it. You are surrounded by all of the coolant that you can ever wish to have. You know, you're on the ocean. And once you've finished with it, or once it comes to the end of its life or needs to be decommissioned, you can effectively return it to greenfield, right? You could take it back to where it came from, and then you can recycle and reuse, etc. So the reason for doing all of this and the buzzword in it is sustainability. Can we actually move towards a nuclear energy system that is fully sustainable in terms of where it's manufactured, how it's deployed, how it is decommissioned, how it is recycled, and how we reuse and recycle the whole time? I mean, there are countries, as you know, where earthquakes and the resulting tsunamis, etc., is a major, major issue for the nuclear industry. Japan comes to mind. Right? You know, the idea that we could have the Japanese shipbuilding industry, the most advanced in the world, you know, making domestic nuclear power stations that are deployed around the coast of Japan, you know, kind of solves energy security in a very different and elegant way for the Japanese. And you can imagine that happening all over the world. We could use this for hydrogen production. We can use it for water desalination. We can use it for industrial heat. We can, all the things we need can be had from this in a very cost-efficient, very sustainable, very environmentally responsible manner. I think that's why there is a momentum there.
Mm-hmm. And in all these ways, overcoming, I think, the problems that we've seen in connection with large land-based nuclear power plants. If I could get you, Mikhail, just to maybe comment on some of the concerns that have been under discussion, particularly about the possibility of the first wave of floating nuclear power plants happening before governance frameworks are at a level where internationally as a community would all be happy with. What are your thoughts and what comments do you have on that, Mikhail?
It's an interesting way of looking at it. And, you know, if you think about it from a legal perspective, or you think about it from an environmental perspective, or you think about it from an industrial perspective or an economic perspective, you come at this from different angles. I mean, look, human history is really one that always has innovation and deployment of new ideas and new technology with inside, if you like, the best rule framework that we can have when it happens. And then the rules grow up around it as people learn how to do this. I mean, look at traffic, look at motor cars, right? I mean, the first motor car that was imported to the United Kingdom, you know, had to have a had to have a person with a red flag walking in front of it, because those were the rules. You had to do that, you know, to warn other road users to use it. And of course, you know, things change. Now we've moved on. The financial industry, you know, energy industry, the food industry, the drug industry, the aviation and retail industry, everybody has rules that evolve as we learn more about it.
I think what's been particularly encouraging for me, Mikhail, is to see the industry, and in particular, the organization that you represent. So this is the hat that you wear as a representative of the World Nuclear Transport Institute. To see you as chair of one of the working groups that's particularly relevant to this issue that we're discussing, taking the lead on governance efforts. I wonder if I could get you to briefly introduce the World Nuclear Transport Institute, Mikhail Winty, and in particular, this working group that you chair.
Yeah, so the World Nuclear Transport Institute, or WINTI as we like to call it, was formed back in the 1980s, and it was an organization that was set up really to look after the interests of those transporting nuclear fuels to power stations overseas, and then spent nuclear fuels coming back for reprocessing. And it was between the United Kingdom and Japan predominantly this happened, which is why the WINTI is based in London. The nuclear transport industry as such, you know, has obviously taken a big knock as nuclear power stations after Fukushima Daiichi were closed down in Japan and less fuel was being moved. And, you know, it hit a bit of an impasse, I think. And, you know, we've been looking for ways to keep the association relevant. And the work that's being done now on floating nuclear ships, and of course, medical radioisotopes comes into this as well. And that's another focus of the organization. You know, it's really the perfect place for that. So we set up this new working group, which is Marine Applications and Nuclear Propulsion Working Group 6. And that working group has as its task really to help form the not the rules, but the logical narrative and using the experts in this industry to really apply what we already know. I mean, you know, if you think about it this way, we've had, you know, over the last 50 years, we've transported over 20 million cargoes of nuclear material, either spent fuels or fresh fuels or something else. And we've never, ever had an incident that hurt anyone or harmed anyone or did anything that was detrimental to the environment. So it has an amazing safety track record and security track record. And we want to use that to make sure that we help form this new platform, if you like, this new framework for how we can move forward and get floating nuclear power plants out there as a solution to global warming and climate change.
I think the other thing that struck us about the work that WINTI is doing in this space is how it's facilitating cooperation between other key actors in the area. So the obvious ones being the International Maritime Organization, the IMO, as well as the IAEA. Is that something that you'd like to comment on?
Yeah, I would like to comment on that. And I think you bring up a very important point, Denise. You know, we have two UN organizations, as you know, and you just mentioned them, the International Public Energy Agency, the IAEA, which is headquartered in Vienna. We have the International Maritime Organization, which is headquartered here in London. And these two organizations are the sort of the UN agencies dealing with nuclear and dealing with maritime. And, you know, of course, being UN agencies by nature, they are slow. They are slow moving because, you know, they act by consensus of all member states. And, you know, there's a wide variety of different, you know, interests and competencies and, you know, what have you in this organization. It's not the place to start to get these things done, because if we do that, you know, we'll our grandchildren will be trying to achieve what we're trying to achieve today. So we need to move forward with jurisdictions and nation states that have, I think, two important components. One, they need to have a competent maritime regulator And members of the IMO, most do have a competent maritime regulator. They also need to have, and this is important, they need to have a competent nuclear regulator. And if the competent nuclear regulator is one that doesn't have any existing experience with running and regulating a nuclear industry in their country, then we almost have to put them into a second tier. So if you overlay these two things together, what we've got is we've got a very small number of nations at the IMO and IAEA that have, if you like, both. And those are the ones that I think we can then start to work with to make sure that they are the ones that set the rules. Because remember, there are three things that matter. You know, you've got safety, of course, which is always top, front and center. We have security, which is important. And we have safeguarding. You know, the basic principles of the International Atomic Energy Agency is safeguarding non-proliferation of nuclear material. We have to be able to run the safeguardings regime through the flag state of a floating nuclear power plant. You can't have, you know, a reactor from one country installed into a floating nuclear power plant built in another country and then sold to just about any country out there that wants it. That country that wants to run that or have that new floating nuclear power plant in its jurisdiction needs to have both a competent maritime regulator and a competent nuclear regulator. So I think we're limited really to a handful of nations to start with where we can do this. These are the nations that will then take these experiences and these rules that have been formed to the IAEA and to the IMO and ask, if you like, for new rules, new regulations, or updates of old rules that already exist. And that's kind of an important thing too, because a lot of this stuff was put in place back in the 1960s, 70s, and to extent also in the 80s. And then it sort of stopped. You know, nothing much happened after that. So it was particularly the Chernobyl accident that sort of stopped everyone in their tracks, and not much happened after. So now, if you like, that new renaissance that we're talking about, it needs member states to bring things to these agencies. WINTI, as an NGO, have observer status at the IAEA. We have consultative status at the IMO, but we cannot be the ones that bring new proposals to them. It has to be done by the member states. So we work with those member states to use the experts in our industry to help, you know, form that framework, to do the gap analysis on what's required to do this, and then provide that work to those member states so that they can then validate it and then take it forward to the international organizations eventually to become, if you like, international. Mm-hmm. International. So that's the part. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, that's perfect. Thank you, Mikhail.
Thank you, Mikhail. I would like to come back to a point that you raised earlier when you talked about existing rules that already try to govern nuclear-powered ships and FNPPs. And I was wondering if you could elaborate on that. What are these existing rules and what perhaps is the way forward in terms of recognizing and dealing with these rules?
Well, it's an interesting area, you know. It's one where I think it's important just to zoom out and look at it for what this actually is. If you go to a nuclear regulator and you say, I'd like to launch a floating nuclear power plant or a nuclear ship, they say, oh, that's got to do with maritime. You've got to speak to the maritime regulator. And then you go to the maritime regulator and say, well, look, I'd like to launch a floating nuclear power plant or nuclear ship. You know, and they say, well, yeah, sure, but you've got to get that licensed by the nuclear regulator. So you're sort of in a Kafkaesque type system where, you know, you can go round and round in circles and nothing ever happens. So the impasse was broken in the 1970s when the International Maritime Organization, as part of actually an effort back in the 60s, 50s, 60s and 70s by the US, by Germany and by Japan to launch nuclear ships, they tried to do this, wrote a chapter on the Safety of Life at Sea Convention that came into force in 1974. And that chapter is Chapter 8. And that Chapter 8 of SOLAS, that's that Safety of Life at Sea Convention is normally referred to as, deals with the safety of nuclear ships. In particular, under SOLAS Chapter 8, there is a resolution which was adopted by all member states of the IMO in 1981. And it's called Resolution A49112. I wish we could think of a better name for it. We just referred to it as 491. So 491 is a safety code for nuclear ships. And it is actually a very intelligent piece of work, but it was written in the 1970s. So it references the world the way it was back then. And back then, we only had one nuclear technology. You know, we had pressurized water reactors, which are the same ones that are used in naval vessels all around the world for the nuclear navies. And it references the systems around that those naval reactors, if you like. And that's not an appropriate technology for shipping. It doesn't, you know, the reason it hasn't worked is because it doesn't work for shipping. So it's also it also looks at, you know, specifically how you deal with all of the auxiliary systems around those reactors, which again, you know, are kind of irrelevant today. So we've got this one lonely bit of ruling that sits in that sort of gap between nuclear and maritime, and it's that rule 491, and it's out of date. It's rusty. It's got paint hanging off it. It's got bits that don't work. But it is an intelligent piece of work, and it has been adopted by all member states of the IMO, and it's been approved at the IAEA as well. So it's the one that everyone references. But what we've got to do is we've got to modernize these rules. We don't have to write new ones. We have to take them and we have to bring them up to date. So in fact, what the World Nuclear Transport Institute is involved in doing now is to do that important gap analysis of what is it that needs to be done to these rules to sort of bring them up to date. How can we rewire it to today's world? How can we, you know, scrape the rust off it and give it a good lick of paint so that it's relevant for, let's say, 2024 or 2025? What we've got is we've got the rules, but they don't really work all that well. So we've got to bring them up to date. Importantly, and I just want to add this without, you know, going on too much about this, is the initial analysis we've done of these rules, when we look at the requirements, both of nuclear ships and floating nuclear power plants, we find that there is, you know, close to 95% commonality and overlap between the two, you know, the two outcomes, if you like, a non-propelled and a propelled ship, or a floating nuclear power plant and a nuclear ship. And we can use the same, we should be able to use the same, you know, refreshed rules to cover both. And that, again, you know, puts a new timeline on this. So instead of this being a 10, 15, 20-year effort at some big international organization, it's the industry that can drive, like, the framework here to say, well, okay, here we've got this, it's been tested, it works, you know, let's move forward with that, and let's sort of chip away at it as we launch new products and as we learn how the various deployment scenarios for both nuclear ships in ports and floating nuclear power plants being transported around the world, et cetera, and how that all works. So I think we've got the bare bones, we just need to make it work. And I think, you know, in the next, say, 5, 6, potentially 7 years, you know, that work's going to bear fruit.
Thank you, Mikhail. I would like to take this opportunity to clarify for our listeners that when you mention Resolution A49112, you are referring to the IMO Code of Safety for Nuclear Merchant Ships that is referenced in SOLAS Chapter 8. It is really interesting to hear you mention that you believe there is a high degree of commonality between nuclear-powered ships and FNPPs, especially in terms of governance requirements. Unfortunately, we do not have the time today to delve deeper into the details of these requirements, including the extent to which the code addresses not just nuclear safety, but also security and safeguards. However, the key point here, I think, for our listeners is really the idea of using an existing code and building upon it for the governance of not only nuclear-powered ships, but also FNPPs. I guess my next question, Mikhail, is what other key opportunities and or challenges do you see in developing the governance framework for FNPPs?
Well, the opportunity is there to be taken, actually. It's there to be grabbed off the table because, you know, there is an enormous momentum building in the maritime industry to actually get new nuclear technologies to function. And it's not just for ships, it's for shipbuilders, it's for nations that have a need to get clean, you know, energy. And this realization that if we combine the best of maritime and the best of new nuclear, we can create something new. And that momentum is building you know, around the world, and it's building rapidly. So, you know, there's an opportunity now to get this done, and that's what WinTE is doing. WinTE is stepping up and saying, okay, we're going to take the first step into the void here, and we're going to make this happen. The challenge is that you come across inertia in the various organizations that you come across. We do need the involvement of the competent maritime regulator and the competent nuclear regulator in key jurisdictions. And of course, they're very busy and they have their mandates and they have, you know, they're independent regulators. They can't be funded by industry. They get their funding because they have to remain independent and proudly so. They have to agree to sort of be part of this. So the challenge is to make them see the momentum that's building in the industry, because they have to react to industry. They can't just sit there. They're not in a white tower. They're not in an ivory tower that says, look, we just do our thing. They have to respond to industry. So, you know, a lot of the work that we've done in the last few years has really been to make visible that that momentum that's building, and to make sure that they're part of that and they can see that. So when, you know, the UK Maritime Coast Guard Agency and the US Coast Guard, for example, they can both see it and they can hear it. I mean, all they have to do is open the window and they can hear the industry talking about it. The nuclear regulators are now doing the same thing. They're going, my goodness, you know, we've heard from our maritime counterparts. They're getting in touch. We haven't spoken to them before, but they're now getting in touch and saying, look, we need help with this and that and the other. So it's starting to get them aligned, try to get them now to be the ones that help to validate this work. Because industry can say, oh, you know, we need all this stuff done and here's how we think it should be done. But, you know, the authorities have to validate, make sure that they're happy with it, because they're the ones that are going to have to take it to the IMO and to the IAEA and ask for these sort of rather larger, important, long-term rule changes. So it has to be done right. And that collaboration, that cooperation, that transparency, that sort of expert group way of working with a clear agenda and a clear goal, I think it's the way to get this done. So we have an ambitious timeline. We have an ambitious target. I think the opportunity is there. The challenges are well defined, and you know, if you sort of, you know, put a bit of effort into it, I think it can be done. So we're confident that this is going to be successful.
That's great.
The world wants it.
Of course, but as you talked about the involvement of the maritime regulator, the nuclear regulator, and the member states, the experts, I'm just wondering, what do you see the role of the international organizations are? Because we did talk about the IMO and the IAEA. To what extent are they playing a part in this development of this governance framework?
And I would add to that, Mikkel, how do you, all the good work that's being done around the gap analysis that you shared of the code that you mentioned, how do you see all of that feeding into discussions that are taking place at the international level?
Yeah, I mean, thanks for bringing that up, Denise. I think it's a sort of, it's a nuanced, a way of nuancing the question that was just asked. And it's, let me put it this way. The way that this work is done is not linear. It's not as if we start where we are today and we take a number of steps and we end up somewhere. You know, it is not something that plateaus from one level to the other until we get to some point in the future. It's really a swirling ecosystem of interconnecting and inter sort of collaborating parts. Now, we've got to start somewhere, you know. We've got to choose where to start, and that's what point I was trying to make, was that we're starting with the industry engaging with its national jurisdictions that it can work. That they will then take this to the international organizations, IMO and IAEA, but we also need those large organizations to be preparing for it. So in a sense, they can't be taken by surprise in 5 years' time when, you know, say a handful of nations come along and say, oh, you know, we'd like this done. And they go, oh, you know, why didn't you tell us before? We have no pre-warning of this. So what's happening at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna is that there are now two separate groups, expert groups, with member states and NGOs involved that are looking specifically at how the agency is going to be receiving and taking this forward. A lot of that is to do with definitions. For example, if a handful of nations came to the IEA and said, look, we'd like to create some guidance documentation and some sort of framework, safety rules for floating nuclear power plants. And the agency doesn't, that's the agency we refer to as the International Atomic Energy Agency. Agency hasn't defined what a floating nuclear power plant is. They'll be scratching their heads going, okay, well, where do we start? So that super important work on preparing that socket, if you like, at the IAEA, where this can be plugged in, is incredibly important. The same at the IMO. IMO, you know, is an organization of member states that debates all manner of things related to maritime. And they've got to have some sort of preparedness and readiness for when the proposals for the updated 491 eventually lands on the table of member states. And it's a procedural thing there. And, you know, and it doesn't stop there, because the next step is then iterations and nuances, et cetera. So we need to create that sort of, you know, receptiveness at these organizations so that we can have, I think of it like plugs. Then you have the socket and you have the plug. We got to create the socket. We're creating the plug at WINTI. We're creating the socket at the IAEA. We have to be able to plug it. We have to do the same thing at the IMO. And that's a lot of maneuvering, if I can put it that way.
Thank you, Mikhail, very much. It's great that you're already preparing the international organizations. All of the actors involved have a role to play in the development of the governance framework for FNPPs. Thanks again.
And our time has gone by very quickly, Mikhail. That leaves me just to say a very big thank you for taking the time to come and share with us about these efforts that WINTI and others are spearheading in this domain. And we wish you all the very best.
Thank you very much, and thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure to speak with you guys, and it's we're always happy to support the CIL.
Thank you, Mikhail.
Thank you for listening to episode 10 of Nuclear Matters at CIL. Have a good day.